Whoever you are, we welcome you. We welcome you to this sacred hour that we set aside each week, taking the time to slow down from busy lives, connect with others, and work on our inner journey. My name is Lisa Teal. I'm serving this morning as worship associate, and I'm joined by service leader Cal Fry, music director Hal Walker, and you all. Who is there that can make muddy water clear? But if allowed to remain still, it will gradually become clear of itself. Be sparing of speech, and things will come right of themselves. This is the symbol of our faith.
I'm gonna lift my sister up. She is not heavy. I'm gonna lift my sister up. She is not heavy. I'm gonna lift my sister up. She is not heavy. If I don't lift her up, if I don't lift her up, if I don't lift her up, I will fall down. I'm gonna lift my brother up. He is not heavy. I'm gonna lift my brother up. He is not heavy. I'm gonna lift my brother up. He is not heavy. If I don't lift him up, if I don't lift him up, if I don't lift him up, I will fall down. Mother, I'm gonna lift my mother up. She is not heavy. I'm gonna lift my mother up. She is not heavy. I'm gonna lift my mother up. She is not heavy. If I don't lift her up, if I don't lift her up, if I don't lift her up, I will fall down.
Father,
I'm gonna lift my father up. He is not heavy. I'm gonna lift my father up. He is not heavy. I'm gonna lift my father up. He is not heavy. If I don't lift him up, if I don't lift him up, I will fall down.
My people,
I'm gonna lift my people up. Now we are not heavy. I'm gonna lift my people up. They are not heavy. I'm gonna lift my people up. If I don't lift them up, if I don't lift them up, I will fall down.
Let the difficulties of the week take their Sabbath now, their brief and simple rest. Let the worries of the week lay their heft gently onto the dark earth below this carpeted floor, which can bear them with greater ease than any one of us can by ourselves. Let the tangle of feelings, the push and pull of these last 7 days, sit still for a minute, stop writhing my heart, and move no more than a Buddha at rest under a tree. Let there be stillness in my heart for a moment, the balance point between breathing in and breathing out, like the pause of a dancer between movements in the music. Let the breathing in this room be free and flowing. Let pulses trance a slower rhythm in the wrist. Let the coming silence be like hands pulling back a curtain, revealing the table set with the feast of life, which is present here and now and has been the whole while. present to those who give up living in either the past or the future. Come, let us worship together.
Part of my message this morning is about mindfulness, which is a large word. Let's stop and think a moment what that means. I thought one good way to illustrate this is with some little poems by John Muth. Haiku are Japanese poems that usually have a strict pattern of syllables, 5, then 7, followed by 5 again. But Muth explains that this isn't always the case in Japan. And many beautiful and thoughtful poems can be made by breaking the rules just slightly. The deeper rule is that haiku usually are about helping us appreciate moments while we experience them, being more in the present. My presence, my experience, transmitted to you. Let's think about a few. These are appropriate for the season, I think. Tiny lights, garden full of twinkling stars, fireflies. Summer morning, up with the kite, send the moon to bed. Killing a bug. Afterward, feeling alone and sad. Violet petal caressing a cheek, butterfly kisses. Water catches every thrown stone. Skip, skip, splash. Becoming so quiet, zero sound, only breath. So writing little poems like these helps us forget all the things that happened yesterday and the things that might happen tomorrow, and just dig in. Really enjoy what's going on right now in a way we can share it with someone else. Have you written your own? You really ought to try it. And I find confining myself to the strict pattern of 5 syllables, 7 syllables, 5 syllables, that structure really helps focus. And I write better poetry, I write better haiku when I don't break the rules, unless I want to do so deliberately.
My prayer this morning is that all human beings will one day see that they are more alike than different. Life can be quite a journey of sorrows and celebrations that make us feel so wholly alive. And you know, we have a personal experience, but we also share in this journey together. It is my deepest hope that everyone here and in the wider world will find a sense of peace in their hearts, because when we feel peace, we spread love.
So the fastest growing segment of the spiritual landscape these days is the group that I prefer to refer to as the spiritual yet not religious. S-Y-N-R, or sinner for short. Many Protestant churches are afraid that these are the folks who used to be found in their pews on Sunday mornings past, while the more evangelical point to this trend as a sorry result of everything that's gone wrong with America today, and surely somehow this too was President Obama's fault. If you ask 2 Unitarian Universalists a question, you'll likely get 3 answers. And even Hal and I up here are having a friendly bit of dialogue about the source of spirituality this morning. It well may be that some of you in this room also consider yourselves more spiritual than religious, and welcome to you. But if we can pull, can we pull every such sinner into our congregations? Probably not. Humanists identify religious experience somewhat narrowly, and we can describe what it might mean to have reverence without a belief in explicit gods or the supernatural. We tend to locate our transcendent experience somewhere out in nature, with a capital N, or the cosmos. And indeed, I have felt great peace and that certain oneness with the universe, either at the telescope eyepiece, or in the depths of the redwood forests, or most frequently for me, somewhere at the edge of the world ocean. Please note that none of these environments are found in this room. No, that sort of spiritual experience is one that's found on retreat, rather remote from everyday life, and indeed remote from our typical Sunday morning gathering. If we hope to find a spiritual experience here together, then we have to be looking for something rather different. All right, for decades, my office has been in a college library somewhere. There's always another book. So I've been taken with Sam Harris's book called Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. Harris studied philosophy and holds a doctorate in neuroscience. He studied functional magnetic resonance in the brain during meditation and similar exercises. In this book, he explores the basis for mind within the brain. And along the way, he dismisses the notion that the mind is somehow separate from the workings of the brain, so far at least as we can discern and measure. So one interesting set of individuals are those who, usually as a last resort cure for debilitating epilepsy, have had their corpus callosum severed, the two halves of the brain separated almost completely. It's remarkable that these so-called split-brained individuals appear to suffer no changes in behavior. But the corpus callosum does more than just hold the two halves of the brain together. We know from studies of various sorts of brain damage that many functions are localized in the brain, some on the left hemisphere, some on the right, many originating in very small regions indeed. So in work that won him the Nobel Prize in 1981, Roger Sperry and his colleagues crafted a series of clever experiments to test each hemisphere individually on a range of tasks. For instance, while speech is generally centered in the left hemisphere, the right brain can communicate by using the left hand to select words or objects. Indeed, Sperry's work shows that the two halves of the brain, so divided, display an astounding functional independence, including separate memories, learning processes, behavioral intentions, and perhaps even separate centers of conscious experience. The classic demonstration of the independence of the two halves in a split brain patient runs this way. Show the right hemisphere a word, egg, let's say, by briefly flashing it in the left side of the visual field, which is only seen by the right side of the brain. And the subject, speaking from the language centers over in the left hemisphere, will claim to see nothing at all. But ask him to reach behind a screen with his left hand and select the thing which he did not see. He will succeed in picking out the egg from a number of random objects. Ask him to name the object that he now holds in his left hand, and he will be unable to reply without letting the left hemisphere get a look at it. Show him the egg. Ask him why he selected it from the objects on the table, and he will probably confabulate an answer, saying something like, "Oh, I picked it because I had eggs for breakfast this morning." This is a really peculiar state of affairs. Another situation he describes in the book is when a young man was asked what he wanted to be when he grew up. With his left brain, he said, "Draftsman." While his right brain, using letter cards and his left hand, spelled out race car driver. In the acute phase, immediately after surgery, patients' left and right hands sometimes engage in a tug of war over an object or sabotage each other's work. Even many years after surgery, the left hemispheres of these subjects express surprise or irritation when their right hemispheres respond to an experimenter's instructions. It's the same as asking them to say what another person is thinking. They don't know. What is most startling about the split brain phenomenon is that we have every reason to believe that the isolated right hemisphere is independently conscious. If those whose left hemispheres have been surgically removed altogether are believed to be still conscious, and they are, how could the mere presence of a functioning left hemisphere rob the right one of its subjectivity in the case of a split-brained patient? In fact, the consciousness of that disconnected right hemisphere is easier to establish than that of most toddlers. Indeed, each hemisphere might have its own beliefs. Consider what this says about the dogma, widely held in Christianity and Islam, that a person's salvation depends on her believing the right doctrine about God. If my left brain accepts the divinity of Jesus and my right brain does not, either I hover in limbo, pulled in both directions at once, or somehow I have developed two immortal souls, one destined for the company of angels and the other for an eternity in hellfire. The question of whether the right hemisphere is conscious is really a pseudo-mystery used to bar the door to a greater one, the uncanny fact that the human mind can be divided by a knife. Did you observe even an inkling of such complexity during your meditation? It's an amazing thing we have there. Let's return to the question of spirituality, perhaps deepened by considering which of our inner selves is at work here. So, Sam Harris became famous for his books, The End of Faith and Letter to a Christian Nation. And he's been described as one of the four horsemen of New Atheism, along with Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, and the late Christopher Hitchens. Although he is an atheist, Harris avoids using that term. His position is that atheism is not in itself a worldview or a philosophy. He believes that atheists should not call ourselves anything. We should go under the radar, perhaps. And he says, while there, we should be decent, honest people who destroy bad ideas wherever we find them. One good idea that Harris takes up stems from the attempt to understand religion without the theology, if you will. After years of exploring the mind, hovering on the margins of both scientific research and religious experience, Harris returns to tell us that it is possible to learn how to be completely and totally present in the moment, what is often called enlightenment, at least for a period of time. He admits that it's also possible to achieve the same state of mind through certain drugs, legal or otherwise, and that his first experiences with this experience came from the use of the drug commonly known as ecstasy. He recognizes the dangers of such drugs and largely recommends meditation as a pathway to spiritual experience. There are many paths to spirituality, and many following a guide or text. Others favor self-exploration. As Universalists, we believe everyone can find the way, and no one needs to fear when the trumpet blows. Harris is perhaps more concerned with the errors one can make that affect us here and now. Let me paraphrase his argument here. Those who attempt to build a bridge between science and spirituality tend to make one of two mistakes. Scientists generally start with what Harris calls an impoverished view of spiritual experience, assuming it must be a grandiose way of describing ordinary states of being, parental love, appreciation of the beauty of the night sky, apparently the kind of experience that I mentioned earlier. Sloppy spiritual thinkers usually enter the ditch on the other side of the road. They idealize other states of consciousness and draw specious connections between subjective experience and the spookier theories at the frontiers of physics. Here we find Carlos Castaneda on the path ahead of us, and here's where we find the claim that the Buddha somehow anticipated modern cosmology or deep quantum mechanics. Okay, we're taking those things a little too far. In the end, when we look at it this way, we're left to choose between pseudo-spirituality and pseudo-science. Fake news. Sad. Okay, first, there are genuine insights we can experience through meditation. Although these insights may tell us nothing about the origins of the universe, they do not have to. They do, however, confirm some well-established truths about the human mind. Our conventional sense of self is an illusion. Positive emotions, such as compassion and patience, are teachable skills. And the way we think directly influences our experience of the world. Spirituality has to be distinguished from religion, because people of every faith, or none, have had the same sorts of actual experiences. While these states of mind are usually interpreted through the lens of one or another religious doctrine, we know this is a mistake, because nothing that a Christian, a Muslim, and a Hindu can experience, self-transcending love, ecstasy, bliss, inner light, none of that constitutes evidence in support of their traditional beliefs, because their beliefs are logically incompatible with one another, and yet the experience is shared. A deeper principle must be at work, and that principle can be approached through several avenues. Harris chooses one which has worked for him and recognizes the arrogance that this represents, but he says it's a small book after all, and one has to begin somewhere. So, Dzogchen is a Tibetan Buddhist term both for enlightenment and a religious practice, a meditation practice, aiming toward the goal of being present in the state of clarity and emptiness through direct introduction to one's own nature. It doesn't strive for enlightenment as much as it recognizes we already possess an enlightened nature, and should spend more time exploring it. There is nothing we need to gain or lose. We only need to recognize and allow ourselves to be as we actually are. It works around threes, whether three goals, three series, three aspects of energy, however you choose to describe and explore it. You can think of one such triad as mind, space, and practice. The Wikipedia article on Dzogchen is particularly dense and perhaps not the best first introduction to the approach. And neither is Harris's book, A Manual on Meditation. But I think overall his recommendation is one that resonates with Unitarian Universalists. The journey is worthwhile all by itself. So I have taken up this form of meditation as a personal practice. And it's one I'm still struggling to find time for in a fairly busy life. A good aid I found was a weekly email of encouragement and guidance that I signed up for from a Buddhist group in Bristol, England. If you want to play along, you can find it at aromeditation.org. That's aromeditation.org. Each week, a fresh lesson is sent out, and they encourage you not to read ahead, as it were, but to practice each step before progressing on to the next. I doubt that I am in much danger of going off and becoming Buddhist. But a modest introduction to a more conscious spiritual practice is worth a try. There are times I have found it very, very valuable. So Harris says, I am often asked what will replace organized religion. The answer, I believe, is nothing and everything. Nothing need replace the divisive doctrines, such as the idea that Jesus will return to earth and hurl unbelievers into a lake of fire, or that death in defense of Islam is the highest good. These are terrifying and debasing fictions. But what about the real message of love, of compassion, of moral goodness, and self-transcendence? Many people still imagine that religion is the true repository of these virtues. And I say that's too limiting. To change this, we must talk about the full range of human experience in a way that is as free of dogma as the best science usually is. It is genuinely possible to be deeply spiritual while at the same time not being religious. A rational approach to spirituality seems to be missing from secularism and from the lives of many people that you meet. Having a clear view of the problem and perhaps some tools may help us solve this for ourselves and offer us another path, perhaps, to share and recognize the enlightenment that we already possess. So I offer you one more metaphor of the task of losing one's monkey mind in meditation and finding selfless enlightenment for a moment. I offer a reflection from Justine Thoms, which she observed during an extended trek across the California desert. My sleep had been light. Often I would open my eyes and check the ever-changing sky. The progress of change was slow. If I slept for half an hour or so between glances, I wouldn't miss much of the show. Gradually, I could detect an ever so subtle light in the eastern sky. The dimmest stars there began to blend in with the newly forming light, and soon only the brightest of planets still shone through the gathering light. On the western horizon, night persisted, with a myriad of stars twinkling from a deep blue sky. Then I noticed the edge of dawn out of the corner of my eye at about 10 o'clock high in the eastern sky. Did I really see it, or was it my imagination? When I looked again, it had disappeared. Oh, it must have been my imagination. Aha, there it was again, the edge of dawn. This time I was sure I had seen it. I discovered that if I didn't look at it directly, but looked at it in that direction without focusing my eyes, I definitely could see the edge of dawn. There seemed to be a distinct dividing line between dawn and night, as if some light-filled dome were closing over the sky. My heart beat faster as I felt like a voyeur looking in on someone else's intimacies, slightly embarrassed, but unable to look away. I was transfixed. The dome kept covering the sky until at last it reached the western horizon. Now the last vestiges of night were gone. The sun came blasting over the eastern slopes. I knew it would be a hot, dry desert day. I wanted to observe this same phenomenon in reverse when evening came on. So several nights later, I settled into my sleeping bag sometime before dusk. As the light of day began to recede, I used my shifting the eyes technique, looking for the dome of night. But oddly, it wasn't coming. In fact, the light seemed to put up a stubborn fight. It would not release so gradually into night as night had into day. I looked from horizon to horizon, east to west, and back again. Surprisingly, there was a ring of light on the entire rim of the horizon. I could not tell where on the horizon the sun had disappeared. No stars were appearing in the east, as I had expected. Suddenly, I saw a star, not on the horizon, but straight above me. Now here were two, three, and the brightness of the sky was giving way to a deepening blue. All of this was taking place directly overhead. The light, in fortifying its hold on the day, put all of its energy on the horizons and left itself thin at the top of the dome. At last, the day could hold out no longer, and opening up to the night sky with a great yawn, it fell back, yielding to the greater presence of night. At that point, I realized something which reversed all my former thinking. Prior to that moment, I had always associated night as obscuring the day, turning everything dark. Now I feel quite the opposite. Night is always there, always surrounding us, like a mother's gentle arms. Day comes and goes for us, but the stars are always there, no matter what is going on in our earthly neighborhood. The veil is the light of day. Day veils the true sky. And now when I look up at the light blue sky of day, I feel comforted by the thought that beyond the brightness is an ever-constant deep darkness of the sky filled with pinpoints of light. I have a sense of profound peace as I feel myself embraced in the arms of the universe. If you sneak up on it, looking aside from the daylight dazzle of our self in thought, may you too find the enlightenment you always had behind the veil and profound peace.
We close this morning with words from Thomas Merton. May your way be lit by the flame of passion, focused by reason's refining lens. May you find joy in reaching out to others and freely accept comfort and support for yourself. May our good works for the world be anchored by a spirituality that places you in contact with life's deeper oneness. And may you have wings to fly and roots to keep you firmly grounded in your own true being. Go in peace to love and to serve as best you are able.